let's go. Okay, we are doing Malbim Perek Gimel. Just kidding, we are doing Miguel's Esther Perek Gimel with the Malbim. Hello, Brechel Brown. So nice to see you. I was just thinking about you tonight and being like, you know, I hope I see her at some point. So hello. I would love to see you. You'll say hello to me after class, maybe. Okay, ready? Malbim Perek Gimel. So we are going to do, again, like we did last time, we're doing a deep dive into the Megillah according to the Mefarish of the Malbim. You'll see the Malbim. It's just like, it's so gishmak. I just walked by. I was like, it's so gishmak. he really gives us like a very different perspective. And I've found so far that each Perek, there's like at least one significant difference between how the Malbim looks at it and how we tend to look at it. And that's where we're going to discuss afterwards. Sarah Phoebs, are you raising your hand? Or is there just like a little hand on you? Oh, that was, okay. No, that's just, there was just a little hand. It was, sorry, it was my cursor on you. That was showing me a hand for some reason. Okay, ready? Let's go. So we're reading inside. Everyone could have it up on there. I'm muted. I'm not muted. Am I muted? No. Okay, my computer told me I'm muted, but it's lying. So everyone can have it open on you, in front of you with an actual Megillah or on Safaria or wherever you want, if you want. Otherwise, I'm going to be reading it inside. Okay, Gimel Achar Hadrim Ha'ila. Gidel HaMelech, which again was basically Esther being chosen as king. Again, the end of Perek Beis, what happened last time, is that Mordechai turns in Migson Maseresh. Esther goes and tells it in the name of Mordechai to the king, which is the first thing that she has done of her own volition that we've seen of her. And the king writes it in his sefer and forgets about it. So, and then that was it. So, Achar Hadrim Ha'ila, Gidel HaMelech Achashverosh Es Haman, Ben Hamdasa, Ha'agi, Vayinas Ehu, Vayesem Es Kiso Me'al Kol Asarim Asherito. So, after all these things, Achashverosh gives Haman a promotion, basically. And Malbim says that this isn't just like stump. By the way, you know, it happened to happen, you know, right afterwards, narratively, that's what happened next. It was a direct consequence. Achashverosh, he says, which again is fascinating. Malbim says, Achashverosh was actually the kind of king who really liked being Makir Tov. He liked, Beshita rewarded people who did good, which is why he wrote down immediately when Mordechai saved his life, he immediately wrote it down in his book, and Malbim calls it like a nath, that he forgot about it. He usually immediately rewarded people and he forgot about it, because that's going to come up later in the story. And we see later on when he realizes he hasn't rewarded Mordechai, he's like horrified about it, and immediately, again, comes up with a very nice reward for him, let's say. And since Haman was the one who suggested that he do this whole pageant at which he found Esther, that was the direct reason for Haman's promotion. So, again, right, like you see Hashem working behind the scenes in this incredible way already in the first pasuk. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'sha'ar ha-melech korim yushachavim l'haman. Ki chen tziva lo ha-melech u'mordechai lo yichara v'lo yushachavet. So again, Haman sort of makes this rule, and Malbim says that usually, of course, you know, nobody would bow down to anybody except for the king, especially in the place where the king also is. So again, if you have an emissary of the king in some other land, you'd expect people to bow down to him. But in the place where the king actually is, nobody would ever bow down to anybody but the king. But the king was like mochel, right? On his kavod, basically. It says, ki chen tziva lo ha-melech, right? The king was like okay with the fact that people would bow down to them. Hi, Emily. But Mordechai refused to. The servants say to Mordechai, "Madua tovera mitzvas hamelech." Right? The king told us that we have to bow down to Mordechai, to Haman. Why aren't you doing this? And they told him again and again, day after day. And he didn't listen to them, meaning he continued to not bow down to Melech. And then he continued to not bow down to Haman. And then they went and told Haman about this. And they told him basically to look out to whether or not the words of Mordechai stood, because they told him that he was a Jew. So again, this is kind of like a convoluted pasuk to understand, that the Malbim gives us understanding of it. Again, the Malbim says this. He says, "Havadim lo misina helshinihu lahaman." Right? The servants weren't trying to slander him to Haman. They actually were basically like on his side. They were basically good-willed people. And that's why they warned him again and again. They basically like, don't do this. Don't do this. Like, it's the will of the king that we have to bow down to Haman. And only once he still refused to do that, they felt like it was their like sworn responsibility as servants of the king to turn him in. Right? They felt like they had to protest against this behavior because it was going against what the king told them to do. They didn't turn him in until they warned him again and again. Okay, so again, keep this in your mind. Like, this is part of the theme of this perek that we're going to be discussing at the end. Okay, and then they tell him this. They say this. This is the logic and how it goes. They said, you know, why wasn't Mordechai bowing down to Haman? In the previous pasuk, it says, you know, everybody's bowing down to Haman, but Mordechai isn't. So what do we learn when we were kids? Why isn't he bowing down to Haman? We have a kid's book that we just got from PJ Library, the people who send out the free books to the kids. And this is like the first time they have a book that has actual content, and they basically just rewrote the Megillah, which is like so beautiful and so great because like we could actually read the book to our kids, which we can't always do. Sometimes we just put it straight in the garbage. It's a great, great organization, but sometimes lacking content. And here, again, the way that they explain it is that like, no, Mordechai said, you know, we don't bow to people. Jews don't bow to people. That was his line. Jews don't bow to people. And it's like, yeah, schmuck. Jews don't bow to people, right? So again, Mabon like puts a little bit of a layer to it and says that Shekinaya derech amim hakadmonim mi'amuni hahazis hahazuyos. I don't actually know what that word means. Leyaches as kol ish shematzu bo iza ma'ala yisera b'chachma u'gavura v'osher lomar shehumi bnei elim v'shakochav o koach elyon shefei alav. Right? It used to be the practice that if you had anybody who was very powerful or had like some sort of, you know, distinct characteristic that was better than other people, you would assume there was some sort of like godly power to this person, right? The gods were smiling on him, or he was somehow connected more than other people to gods. So when you bowed down to him, you did it in respect to this godliness that he had, right? This like this koach from God that he had. And that was what Mordechai was protesting to. So the in this pasuk, Malbim says that the logic went like this. They told Haman, listen, Mordechai isn't bowing down to you. But maybe it's only because he can't see you. Because it used to be that if Haman walked from afar, if you were respecting, again, the God capacity of him or whatever as like a God-given whatever person, then you would have to bow if you see him from afar because you're basically respecting the God, not him. But if he went close to you, now there's a different reason that you're bowing down. Now you're not only bowing down, so to speak, because of this godliness factor, but now you're bowing down because, like, he's a powerful figure and you're bowing down to him, right? This is basically what the Japanese do, don't they? Like, when you have someone who is, and we've seen this sort of culturally much more often. You have somebody of power or of stature come in and you, like, do a bow, right? We've seen that, especially in olden days, sort of depictions of stuff. So they were claiming, or Haman, at least, his logic also was, you know, it could be that from a religious vantage point, he's refusing to bow down to me from afar because he thinks that I have... Oh, interesting. In any culture, they bow to parents and in-laws. Thank you. Hana, right? Exactly. So again, this sort of... you're recognizing the stature. So he figured if he's not bowing down to me when I'm far away, it could be that he is not bowing down to me because he doesn't believe in the godliness factor, which it sounds like maybe he was willing to forgive or at least buy that. But he said, if I'm close to him and he's still not bowing down... that means he's basically refusing to accept my stature. He's refusing to accept my higher status than him and my like srara, right? My like rulership, basically. And that is just a personal vendetta that Mordechai must have against me, and I'm gonna have a personal vendetta against him. So that's why it said, right? V'yagidu l'Haman lir'os. They told Haman, like, go check it out. Go like do this trial and see whether or not Mordechai will actually bow to you when you're close enough to see each other face to face. If the reason that he's not bowing to you is because he's a Jew, then he should still bow to you when you're close, but not bow to you when you're far down, when you're far away. And Haman sees that Mordechai is not bowing down to him. Right? It's that it's a personal thing. He came close enough, saw that Haman was not bowing down to him, and was like, that's it. This is like a personal vendetta, and he, again, launches into this whole plan. Interestingly, Malbim does not go on and explain what Mordechai's calculation was, meaning why wasn't Mordechai bowing down to Haman even at close proximity, and whether or not that was actually related to his religion or not. So it's kind of ambiguous. My assumption is that, like, Malbim was saying that we still don't bow down to people. I don't know, but would Malbim say that Indians shouldn't bow down to their in-laws and parents? Like, I don't know. I'm not really sure because Malbim does not weigh in on that, on like the Mordechai's cheshbon, just on the servants and Haman's discussion about it. Okay, Vayivas ben Inav. Yeah.
Wait, but I thought that was like even like kings and like I guess, like, figures that, like, we don't look at as, like, godly figures, but, like, still, like, kings or and whatnot. Like, we're still supposed to bow down, aren't we?
I don't know. So I'm not sure. I mean, I don't know the halacha about it. For sure, as a kid, I learned, like, no, you don't do that, right? We didn't bow to Nebuchadnezzar. We don't bow to Ahasuerus. But there's also, there's always, like, the piece in it of, like, are these people expecting you to bow down to them from, a, like, a godly place? Or do they expect you to bow down to them because of themselves and their status? Or are they expecting you to bow down to them because they feel like they're representations of God, in some of a God in some capacity? So that argument, again, I think that's the basis argument, but Malbim does not weigh in.
Isn't that completely already not being a representation of God if you feel you're a representation of God that people need to know?
What do you mean?
Like, that someone who feels, at least as, like, as what we believe, if they're a representation of God, like, it's all the guy that to be like, everyone should bow down to you because I'm a representation of God.
Yeah, exactly. But the question is, I guess, the nafkamina would be, if somebody would say, I'm not a representation of God, but you should anyways bow down to me, right? If you should say, in our culture, the way that we do it is that if I have a higher status than you, you should bow down to me. Would we bow down to somebody like that, or do we still have an issue with that as Jews?
I'm thinking of, like, let's say, like, if someone saw, like, the Queen of England, okay? Like, I don't know how often this happens, but let's say someone saw, like, the Queen of England, okay? Like, I thought that, like, we're supposed to bow in, like, that,
in that context. Right. So again, it could be that we are. I don't know. And Malbim, again, does not enlighten us here. Malbim does not weigh in. It sounds like if that was the case, why didn't Mordechai bow down to Haman? Because also of the godly thing, but then it would have been different if you're close in close proximity or far proximity. So why didn't Mordechai just bow? I don't know. It sort of implies that Mordechai felt like no matter where Haman is, we don't bow to people. But maybe that's too simple. And like you're saying, it's actually like, if there's no Havamina that you're bowing to the God in the person, is it okay to bow to people? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. And Malbim does not enlighten us. So we're left a little bit in the dark of like Mordechai's cheshbonos of why he didn't bow. But again, obviously we assume that that's the right, he did the right thing there. Okay. Continuing. Good questions. Continuing. Vayivez be'inav lishloach yad b'mordechai. And it was like low in his eyes to only send out his hands against Mordechai, Levado. Ki giru lo as am Mordechai. Because they told him, the nation of Mordechai, v'yavakesh Haman lahashmid es kol ha-Yehudim. And Haman decides from this one instance that he's going to destroy all of the Jews. Asher b'chol malchus ha-Chashverosh am Mordechai. Because they're the nation of Mordechai. So again, Malbim says, like, it's an incredible thing, right? Misaper rishas Haman v'ga'uso, right? It shows you the extent of the evil of Haman, that really he had already established that he thought that he was upset at Mordechai because it was a personal vendetta against him, right? It wasn't because of his nation, of his religion that he wasn't bowing, because then he would have bowed close in close proximity. So if he also didn't bow in close proximity, it must be a personal vendetta. So now Haman is upset at Mordechai, but he still extends it to destroy his whole nation. Right? It's not good enough to just destroy Mordechai. Now he wants to destroy everybody. Shagam ikir haketzav haya al Mordechai. Achar shenir be'inav shalo mitzad dato nimnali shachavos lo rak misina so-so. Right? He'd already established that he thinks that Mordechai has something against him personally, but he's still going to destroy the whole people. It also just shows you, right? Like, again, you have to see this from the Jews' perspective watching this play out. Like, in their mind, the entire Purim story happened because Mordechai didn't just bow down to Haman, right? They were all, can you imagine this? Can you imagine if, like, you know, again, the president of the United States or whatever walked down the street and, like, Rav David Feinstein didn't bow down, and then he decided that he's going to expel every single Jewish person from America or kill them, right? We'd all be like, Rav David Feinstein, like, just bow that, just bow down. Like, Reuven Feinstein, right? Wait, what is it? Okay. Right, Rav David Cohen, that's what I meant to say. Like just bow down. Just bow down. What's the big deal, right? Like, in their minds, the whole thing happened just because Mordechai refused to bow down. But again, that's the Ben Hapohu, right? It was actually only because of Mordechai that they were all saved. Okay, b'chodesh ha-rishon hu chodesh Nisan, b'shnas shtim asrei lemelech Achashverosh. So in the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of the reign of Achashverosh, he peel poor. And again, I think, what was it? I'm actually not thinking, I didn't look this up, but I think Esther was crowned in the 7th year, right? And this is already the 12th year, so it's, I'll look it up after. I think it's 5 years later. Oh, my baby is not happy today. He keeps waking up. Okay, Shema Yisrael Lamelech HaKashverosh, Ki Bil Pur, Hu HaGora, Lifnei Haman, Miyom Liyom, Michodesh LeChodesh. So he does a lottery from day to day, from month to month, Shnei Masar Hu Chodesh Adar. Shnei Masar Hu Chodesh Adar. Okay? And it lands on the 13th of the month of Adar. So this is what Malbim says, is that, again, it was some sort of, like, lottery that he said was, like, very common to do back then, and Haman made a lot of decisions in this way by doing a lottery. Okay, it seems to be that there was a way that you would pick a date and it would tell you yes or no, the lottery. When you think of, like, you put all the dates of the whole year, he puts 365 pieces of paper into a bucket, and you shake it up and you pick one out, right? Malbim says that's not how he did it. First he did, it was the 13th of Nisan when he was doing this Gorel. So he wanted to do this as soon as possible. So first he did of the days of the month, I mean, of the days, right? The days like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, it was the 13th. So we started with the 14th, saying, well, maybe it's tomorrow, I should destroy them. And he went through 14, no, 15, no, 16, no, 17, no, 18, no, until he got all the way around back to the 13th, which it was. So it came back on the 13th, and he was like, well, okay, fine, so maybe the month is off. Like, obviously it's not today, because this is his idea today. It has to, like, and he doesn't want to take a whole year to get to fruition. So he's like, maybe it's the month that's off. So then he starts going through all the months. And it goes like, you know, Nisan, Iyar, no, Siva, no. And he goes again and again and again and again until he comes up with the last month of the year, which is Adar. So basically was the last possible date that it possibly could land on, which was the 13th, the day that it already was, and the last month of Adar. And that's why it says that he did Yom Li Yom, Echodesh Echodesh. And Malbim says, again, what would have changed had he done it the other way around? What would have changed had he done it with the months first? First he would have gotten the months, and it was Nisan, he would have gotten Adar, the last month. And then he would have done the dates, what would he have gotten? The last day of Adar. Right? So basically, whenever Haman chose to start, it was the last possible day that the lottery could have landed on. And Malbim says, like, Haman should have realized here, by the sheer odds against that, that there was already some, like, supernatural power taking care of the Jewish people. But, like, he missed it. Of course he missed it. Okay. And where are we? Okay, so he chooses a date. And what's he going to do on that date? Okay, and we know again what he's going to choose to do on that day, which again is to take revenge basically against Mordechai and his whole nation. So now Haman is trying to convince Ahasuerus to get in on this plan, because he can't just do it by himself. He needs the approval of the king. There's this like little nation that's spread out and like strange from all of the other nations, and they're in all of the provinces of the king. And their laws are different from everyone else's. And they don't listen to anything that you say. And it's not really worth it for you to just like leave them alone. So again, so Malbim says, like, this is here we see Haman's strategy. How is he trying to get Ahasuerus on his team, basically on his side? And he does this. So Haman reads that Haman basically lied and he fooled Ahasuerush. He gunavas leave Ahasuerush. He misled him in several ways. Bishnei dvarim. Achad shelo hodia lo mihu ha'am hazeh shemal shein aleihem. He doesn't tell him the name of the people. He doesn't tell him there's this nation called Jews, Yehudim, and they are spread. He talks about this random nation. And Malbim says this. Listen to him. She'im haya Ahasuerush yodea shehim ha'yehudim. Had Ahasuerus known that he was talking about the Jews, he never would have agreed to it, because the Jews had a great reputation. They were known to be a nation that was Chacham Venevo. They were intelligent and they were wise and they were useful people in the kingdom. Let me read you that piece that I just skipped. Okay, but had he known, even if it was some random people and not the Jews, had he known that what Haman wanted was to destroy them completely, like actually kill them, he also never would have agreed. And he's going to go back into that later. Okay, so then he also, Haman talks about Mithuzar, Mifurad, right? They're in all the provinces. They're all separate. It's not like you have like these isolated cities that we could do like very easily. We could just ignore them or isolate them and they don't bother us. He's like, no, you know, they're spread out. They're all over the place. And they're basically like maybe fomenting some sort of like disrest. They're not listening. They have bad laws. Like, you know, he kind of like paints this picture of them that like this is a cultural, like nationalistic issue that you have on your hands, and like let's take care of it together. Okay, so like that's how he paints this picture for Ahasuerus. V'im al hamelech, Sorry, let me just make sure I didn't forget something. Yeah. Okay. Imal Hamelech Tov. If it's good in your eyes, Yikasev La'abdam, let's destroy them. And a certain amount of money will weigh, and they'll pay you. The people who are doing the work will pay you to do the work, and will put it in your treasury. That's what he says. So again, Malam says this is the second way that he deceived Achashverosh, that he told him that, like, la'abdam, Malam sees it as like a very ambiguous word. He's basically saying, you know, the issues that exist with them, the issues that they're not listening to the king and whatever, like, you know, let's destroy those issues. But Achashverosh never dreamed that Haman was telling him to actually destroy the people. And again, he says Achashverosh never ever would have agreed to that. Right, just it destroy, like, help them assimilate, help them, you know, enculturate. Yeah.
Sorry, another question. So I thought that, like, Ahasuerus was, like, a really horrible person that, like, wanted to kill, like, I heard that, like, he wanted, like, all the Jews to die.
Good. So that is the major theme that Malbim is obsessively bringing to our attention here. Okay, and that's what we're going to discuss at the end. Malbim has an extremely, extremely different picture of Ahasuerus than what we're used to. Again, if you look at, let's say, the illustrated Megillas, you see one of two depictions of Achashverosh. He's either this, like, evil, like, person who looks as evil as Haman with, you know, the scary eyebrows and whatever, or he's, like, some bumbling fool who's just, like, getting tweaked around by everybody else. Like, he's everyone else's marionette.
Right.
So, like, in my kid's book that they just got, he's, like, this, like, ambiguous character. He just, like, he looks like a king, and he just, like, does what other people tell him to do, basically.
So Malvin thinks that he's a fool, basically.
No. Listen to how Malbim thinks him, okay? So what did we already learn about? We're going to go back to that then, Yasmin. That's exactly the discussion we're going to get into, okay? Shkoyach, good. Okay. Thank you for pointing that out, okay? So he says, Lo kivein Achashverosh klal el harigat evud nafoshos. Achashverosh never agreed to actually destroy people's souls. He would never have agreed to that, right? Haman totally fooled him. He didn't know that what he was talking about. Haman was ambiguous enough, and Achashverosh trusted Haman enough that he agreed. Then he says, you know, listen, and the people who are going to do the work are going to pay you. Meaning, what Haman is trying to say is, like, this is a cultural issue. Nobody likes these people. They're sort of like, they're creating some sort of, like, disrest, and everybody really wants to get rid of them because we all want to have, like, a united front as a nation. So the people who are going to do the work of, like, trying to basically assimilate these people and re-educate them to be, you know, good civilians, they really want to do the work. They're going to pay you to do the work. Okay, Vayesar Melech Astabaso Me'al Yado. The king takes off his ring. Vayidnehala Haman Ben Hamdasagi Ha'agagi Tzor HaYehudim. And he takes off his ring and he gives it to Haman Tzor HaYehudim. And he goes, here's Malbim. Vayesar Ata Mesapir Ki HaMelech Lo Ashem Bedavar Zem Uma. This pasuk is telling us that the king Achashverosh was not guilty at all here. He was not to blame at all. Ki Achash ganav libo v'lo higid lo miha'am. After Haman again deceived him in these several ways, v'lo shedato lahashmidam, and he doesn't tell him that he's actually intending to kill them. Im hayah hamelech atzmo hosim ha'igros hayah roeh ki mirma b'davar v'lo hayah maskim imo. Right, the king gives Haman his ring because had the king had to seal the letters himself, he never would have done it. Had the king himself sealed the letters with his own ring, he would have been like, I'm not doing this. This is insane. I'm not killing the Jews. They're good people. And I'm not killing a whole nation just because I'm not killing a whole nation. But instead, it says the king trusted Haman. He was deceived of what Haman's intentions were. And he gave him the king and him the ring so that Haman did everything himself. And that's why this pasuk identifies Haman alone as the oppressor of the Jews. Right? He says that's the function of this pasuk. Vayezer HaMelech. Estabasome al yado v'yitneha l'haman ben hamdasa ha'agagi, right, from Amalek, tzorer ha'yehudim. He's the one who's the bad guy. He's the one who's oppressing the Jews, and Achashverosh would not have done it. He would not have done it if he knew about it. V'yomer ha'melech l'haman, ha'kesem nasun lach, v'ha'am la'asos bo katov b'enecha. And the king says, you don't have to pay me to do it. I believe you. I think this is a cultural issue. I'm on your page. And I don't want anyone to think that I just did this for the money that I would have gotten paid. So don't pay me. I'll pay you. I agree with you. This is an issue. Yeah, one second. Let me just read it to you inside, and then please ask me a question. Chavi, that was Chavi, right? Okay, I'm going to assume that it was. Okay, and just listen to how Malbim, again, sees Achashverosh's role here. Hamalach bal yachshov adam she'asa zeh ba'avor kesef. He doesn't want anyone to think that he did it for the money. Ki adarabah. He doesn't want to do it for the money. In his mind, he's doing a favor for these people. He's helping obliterate their bad cultural nonsense that's bad for them and that's bad for the nation. And he actually said, "L'haser ha'machshela ha'yotza me'roa dasam b'han hagasam l'tov lahem." He thinks it's going to be better for them at the end of the day, for them to go through this, whatever this process is that he's imagining in his head, Haman is talking about, because Haman has correctly deceived him. Okay, now ask me your question.
Isn't there, I just feel like the Malden is taking responsibility on behalf of theirs, but there is still some kind of responsibility if your kingdom, you gave away your reign.
Right.
He's trying to make you rethink Ahasuerus at the same time, like, it's still Ahasuerus' fault.
I hear you, right? Like, if Ahasuerus was being taken to a court, you would, what's the term for it? Was Esty on this call? No. Right, the term for it is like, you know, what's it called? Something negligence, like you're negligent, so you didn't mean to. Like, let's say your car had like a beeping thing that was telling you that some part of it was broken, and you don't fix it, and because of that, like, you crash and you like crash into somebody on their bicycle. So you didn't mean to crash into them on the bicycle. You didn't hit them on purpose on your bicycle, but you were willful negligence. You were willfully negligent. You didn't do something that would have kept other people safe. So Javi, I agree with you. I don't think he's making Ahasuerus to be a tzaddik per se. Right, but and again, it was like a little doofy of Ahasuerus to just like give away his ring and to not check about what's going on in this kingdom. And again, you see the fact that Mordechai was like living in Shushan and they can't figure out who Esther is. Like, he doesn't have the most organized, well-run kingdom, which is like fascinating to think about. Like, you know, the levels of bureaucracy and what's going on. Like, he had no idea who Esther is, even though she's like from his kingdom, and they got her from the house of Mordechai. But somehow, no one could put those two pieces together and tell him who Esther was. So, like, again, he's not the most on target king. And I don't think he's trying to obliterate him from all blame, but he is making a massive distinction between the rishis of Haman and Ahasuerus. Okay, so let's keep going, because like he's going to do it again. He's not done. And then we're going to review what he's done here, and then we're going to talk about it again. The paragraph is almost over. Fear not, the paragraph is almost over, and then we will discuss this. Okay, vayikru sofrei hamelech b'chodesh harishon b'shlosha asar yom bo. All right, again, so on that very day, he goes to the scribes of the king. So on that very day, he's now worried. Haman now feels the clock ticking, because he knows that if Ahasuerus finds out what he's actually writing on these letters, there's no way they're going out. So that very day, he gets the scribes to write exactly what he wants, and he seals it with the stamp of the king. Again, he seals it with the stamp of the king. Nobody in the entire world knows what's written on these letters except for Haman. Okay, this is part of his strategy. And then what does he do? Vanishlach sfarim b'yad haratzim, and immediately he sends the people out with the scrolls. El kol medinos ha'melech l'hashmi l'harog l'abed. As kol yudim. Now he's telling us what's written on the parchment, but only us. Okay, this is how Malam reads the next few psukim. Vanishlach Svarim Biyad, so he has them write it that day, and he sends them out that day. Vanishlach Svarim Biyad Haratzim Akol Medinos Hamelech Lahashmin Laharog Ulaabed Eskola Yehudim Minar Biyad Zakin Taf Noshim Biyom Echad Vishlosha Asar Lachodesh Shneim Asar Hu Chodesh Adar Ushlolam Lavot Lavos. He sends it out on that day to everybody to, again, kill every single Jew on the 13th of Adar, which is 11 months away. Pashegin haksav. So pashegin is another term for a letter. Okay, pashegin haksav. The wording of that's written on the letter. Kinasein das b'chol medina u'medina gives the law in every nation. Golui l'chol ha'amim, that was open to all of the nations. Lihios asidim layom hazeh, to be prepared for that day. So Malmim says this. This is what happened. Haman on that very day wrote down the decree to destroy the Jews on the 13th of Adar. And he seals it, and he sends it out. And he sends it out everywhere before sending it out in Shushan, because again, he's afraid. He wants to make sure that this letter has the best chance of getting out without Ahasuerus finding out. So he sends it out everywhere. Along with this letter, with this closed, sealed parchment, he sends an open letter. And the open letter says to everybody, be prepared for war on the 13th of Adar. In 11 months from now, be prepared for war. On that day, you can open the sealed envelope and you'll find out who you're fighting against. So that's what he sends out. Okay? What benefit was that? Why was that a great strategy, so to speak, for Haman to take according to his plan? What does it do practically?
It's it factors in timing, like nobody will be able to stop it. But also another question, like, he's relying on the whole public to just kill out the Jews, like they hated us that much, or they were
good. So what's he relying on? It's a good point. I forgot to say this parasha of the Rambam. What's he relying on?
And then, like, creating confusion.
Good. He created confusion here. That's what he's doing here. But what's he relying on? It's not that they hated the Jews. It's that
they didn't read the letter.
The king, no, the king gave them a decree, right? It's not that their opinion doesn't matter. The king told them, you must kill, and it's written from the king, and it's sealed with his seal as a law. The law is, you must kill the Jews on this day. Interesting what you just said, Chana, because you reminded me that the Malbim's prayers on the previous pasuk, where he sent it to each different nation, is that he didn't tell them that he was sending it to everybody. So every nation wasn't sure whether or not they were the only ones who got this letter. In which case, they felt a lot more accountability to actually follow through on it. They felt like, oh my gosh, I don't know if the king is telling me to do something, in which case we had better do it, because he's going to have his eyes on us, whether or not we did it. They didn't realize this was like a national decree to everybody. So again, he's creating, like Bracha said, he's creating some sort of like confusion also there, that everybody is worried that they're gonna be accountable for following what the king said.
Just to clarify, it was written as you must kill or yeah. Like, can kill?
No, you have to. Okay, so you must do two things. You must prepare for war, and you must follow the instructions on the sealed envelope on the 13th of Adar. You must wait to open it until the 13th of Adar. When you open it, you have to follow those instructions. And those instructions said, kill every Jew. So again, Malbim says, according to this, Haman's idea, like Haman's plan, was that the Jews would also prepare for war. Because everyone is preparing for war. They just don't know who they're fighting. So the Jews in all those nations would be also preparing for war, preparing to fight somebody. And on the 13th of Adar, they would open it up and realize that it's the Jews they're supposed to be fighting, and they would get decimated by their people.
The Jews can fight back?
Yeah, I mean, the assumption was that they were going to fight back. They can't, but they're going to get killed, so.
So, like, jumping in the future, like, the other person, like, how did Ahasuerush, like, oppose that decree that he couldn't revoke? Like, he couldn't take that?
Yeah, he couldn't take it back because it was sealed with his stamp.
Right, so that, what was the second thing that he sent out? That the Jews can defend themselves, right?
Yeah, later on.
But then what's the difference now? Like, in the first decree, they can also defend themselves. So how is that, like...
Well, I think that they couldn't revoke it. Again, I don't know because I haven't read Malbim on that psukim yet, so it's a good question. They couldn't revoke, right? It seemed like that was the system at the time, was that they couldn't revoke the decrees that already went out, but they basically were saying, like, now the Jews are allowed to fight back, and they're allowed to gather their own ammunition, they're allowed to gather, right? And again, it was still months in advance of when it happened. So when it actually happened, the Jews were more prepared. A lot of other people would be like, I'm not getting involved in this. And again, you see it was a civil war. Like, they didn't just back off. The Jews did defend themselves, and they did kill out people. Like, there was a civil war that happened because of it.
Then the first one, they also could have.
They would have, but they wouldn't have known, right? They would have been caught totally off guard, right? Everybody would have felt like, okay, last minute, we're told, we're ready to fight. They all show up, and it's like, go kill the Jews. And again, this huge conglomerate of people would have gone to kill the Jews, and the Jews would have been, like, totally, you know, shocked by it. And instead, like, there were months to prepare, so everyone could, like, you know, try to figure out whether or not they did or did not want to join this battle. And again, they know that Ahasuerus now doesn't actually want them to fight because Esther is the queen, right? So he's not going to punish people who don't fight. So it's, like, a very different kind of cultural experience now. Now it seems like, again, your question from before, it seems like when it actually happened, the people who were anti-Semitic, right, people who didn't like the Jews and wanted to fight them anyways were the ones who fought. Everyone else could sit back and be like, we're not going to get punished for not fighting. Right? There's no Havamina that Ahasuerus actually wants us to do this. The people who were anyways anti-Jew tried to do it, and they were decimated by the Jews, who had a lot of time to prepare themselves. And again, now they had people in position of power, right? By this time, Haman was already dead. His sons were hung, right? Mordechai and Esther are now ascending. Everyone knows who they are. And you're still going to fight the Jews? Like, you got to be a little bit suicidal to do that. Like, you know the king doesn't want that. But good question. Like, trying to work it out. What happened? Okay, good. Blah, 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 blah. Where are we? Okay, Haratzim Yatsu Dechufim. The runners went out immediately. Bidvar Hamelech v'hadas nisna b'Shushan Habira. And again, the last place to learn of this was Shushan Habira. The last place that he released this, just in case the king would find out. He wanted everything to already be working, that he couldn't recall it. What was the benefit of this? Right. What was the benefit of his first plan? Right. That the Jews couldn't appeal for help to anybody. Again, had they known about it 11 months earlier. They couldn't appeal for help, which again, you know, Chana, this is what happened when they did know about it. They couldn't appeal for help to the king. They couldn't appeal for help for any allies. They couldn't run away. They couldn't hide, and the king didn't know about it. So he couldn't repeal it either. He couldn't make known his intentions here. So that was like the strategy of keeping it secret until the last minute from Haman, which again is a genius strategy. Let's just call it spade a spade. So, and the king and Haman sit down to a party, to drink together, not to party, but to drink together, and Shushan is confused. Everybody is confused. So again, listen to Malbim over here, listen how he reads this. Siper od l'raya, right? This pasuk is additional proof. Shehamelech lo yadami kol zos me'uma. The king has no idea what's going on behind his back. Ki yashav im Haman lishtos, because he sat down with Haman to drink. V'imahaya zeh b'yidiaso, litein das la'aved uma shlema, ve'ich yashav az lishtos. If he actually had just given the decree to destroy an entire nation, how could he possibly be drinking? How could he possibly then sit down to drink? He would never have done that. Okay, because even, people who pass capital judgments against people, meaning who decree people for death, even they don't sit down to drink. So Achashverosh never would have done that. Okay? So again, he started this parak. That's the end of the parak. So he started this parak saying, Achashverosh was the kind of king who was relentless about being makir tov to people. It was a miracle that he forgot to reward Mordechai for saving his life. And then he davka ascended Haman in the ranks because he had helped him find Esther and he wanted to be makir tov. Right, and then we learned that the servants again were not. They didn't want to slander Mordechai to Haman. They weren't anti-Mordechai. They just had to because they were the servants of the king, and he wasn't listening. So they warned him. When they had no other choice, they sent him and they slandered him. Right, we learned that Haman is the one who is the oppressor of the Jews, and again had all of these ways of strategizing that nobody knew actually what he was going to do, and that even though he was mad at Mordechai, he decided to destroy everybody, even though he had already established it had nothing to do with religion, right? And then we learn again that the king didn't know what was going on. Haman had his seal. He didn't know what was happening. Had he known what was happening, two times, right? Had he known what was happening, he never would have destroyed a nation. He never would have attacked the Jews. He never would have let, he never would have sat down to drink if he had known, even accidentally, that he had just done this. So again, this is our big question, right? Like, frankly, I think that a lot of the places that Malbim reads it could be ambiguous, which is why you can read it both ways, right? Malbim's not like saying, everyone else is wrong, there's no way you could read it this way. Again, let's say Pesach Tezvav, right? The last Pesach, where they both sit down to drink. So Malbim's saying it's a proof that Achashverosh is not bad, because otherwise, how could he have sat down to drink? But you could also look at it and say, it's a proof that Achashverosh is as bad as Haman, because look, they're both sitting down to drink after they just did this. Right? So like, why, and what does it change? Not why, but what does it change? What does it change when we learn the Megillah like this? That again, Achashverosh is a very different person, and even everybody, right? Like Malbim, whatever he can read good intent, he does. And the only person he reads ill intent for, and massive amounts of ill intent, is Haman. So why? What does it change for us to learn it like this? I don't necessarily have one answer. I have like a few thoughts, but I actually want to open that up because I'm wondering about it myself. It's a real question. Why? What does it change for us? What does it teach us? Why? Like, I don't want to say why. I don't know. I can't answer the question of why is Malbim saying that, but what does it change to see Achashverosh this way?
It becomes a story about manipulation rather than like a story of it. Another kingdom that just doesn't like Jews.
Good. So tell me more about that, Chavi. Very interesting, right? It becomes a story of manipulation versus just like another place that was anti-Semitic and hated us as a whole.
Right. I guess it's more like Haman's anti-Semitism running the show, so he's manipulating everyone to feel it too, but it's not necessarily something else about.
Right. It isolates Haman. Exactly, Chavi. I agree with you, right? The fact that he's letting Achashverosh off the hook in some capacity, and the servants, and I assume that Malbim will keep doing it. Anywhere he could read good intention, he's going to. And I guess I'll tell you next time, right? But it changes. The fact that everyone else is blameless makes Haman more to blame, right? It puts the onus of the story more on Haman's shoulders. It's not that he was collaborating with everyone. Like Chavi said, he's manipulating all the circumstances because he is... hates the Jews. which makes his level of evil, in my eyes, right? And it seems like the mob I'm saying this too, his level of evil rises and everyone else's level of evil falls. So yeah, Javi, right? It does change that. It does change that. Like, we see this much more as, like, the central evil here is Haman and no one else.
Maybe it's trying to, like, differentiate, like, a Malik's type of hatred towards the Jews. And I think, like, maybe that's, like, what this, like, a big aspect of the story, like, not regular hatred. Different nations can hate each other, mm-hmm. but, like, this is about a Malik hating us and, like, unfortunately forever. And it also, like, the whole time we were talking about this, it kept them thinking of, like, Hitler and Maximo, like, he as well, like, he was behind everything. Like, he was the number one force. I don't think any other human would have had, like, the audacity to do something like that. Of course, everybody hated it, but hated the Jews, but it was fueled. And it also, like, he represented Germany and, like, a certain type of people, which is basically everybody that tried to kill the Jews. So it's, like, not a reg... That's, again, it's like a Malik. It's mm-hmm. and this time now, like, Parshat Sachar, like...
Mm-hmm.
regular hatred.
Yeah, I think so too, right? That's part of what I was thinking, and I love the way that you expressed it. Like, yeah, it's a different kind of evil. It's not just like a stum evil, like, you know, people were anti-Semitic and they didn't like the Jews. There's like a different qualitative level of evil of Haman, and that's part of the story, right? Part of the story is the downfall of that kind of evil, which is qualitatively different than, you know, some bumbling fool or someone who gets manipulated by somebody else or people who just like stum, don't mind turning Mordechai into Haman if they have to, you know. But yeah, it's like a different, right? It's a different qualitative type of evil. Yeah, and fascinating what you said about Hitler also, right? Like, everyone else were people, this is kind of how we see the Holocaust a lot, everyone else were people who got manipulated or pulled into some sort of, like, psychological, sociological movement, right? But Hitler was the one who was the pawn who started the whole thing. If you guys listen to Arnold Schwarzenegger, I forgot who sent me this video, like, near the election, had a whole, actually after, like, the storming of the Capitol, he came out with, like, a 7-minute video about growing up in Austria post-Holocaust. It's fascinating. You should look it up online if you haven't seen it. And he basically says that, like, his father and a lot of the fathers of his friends were all Nazis, basically. And, like, they had horrible amounts of guilt of living with themselves, knowing what they had done and what they had seen. And that it was, like, very bad as a kid growing up with adults who had that amount of guilt, basically. Yeah, I'll try to share the link. It was, right now? So, like, that, again, it was, yeah, you know?
Yeah, please share that. It's kind of crazy.
It was crazy, yeah. I mean, it was chetzi political, but that piece of it blew my mind. You know, because we know the story from the other side. We know the story of the kids of the survivors, and he's a kid of the perpetrators. So yeah, I agree with you guys. I mean, any other thoughts? Like, what is?
I have a question, but it's like more logistical rather than you taught earlier. I didn't really understand anything with the raffle. Like, I thought Haman just, like, this is how I was always taught as a kid. Haman, you know, picked from the raffle, and it was just whatever random day and month came out, that's what he did. I didn't really understand what you were saying about how it was, like, the last month that we kept picking, and then it was, like, the last month, the last day.
So Malbim reads it that again, it seems to be, again, we see that you put, you know, all the dates into a hat and you pick one out. But his, again, the way that Malbim sees it, there must have been some way to say yes or no about every individual date. So basically he picked up it was the 13th. So he picked up the 14th, like, can I do this tomorrow? And the answer was no. And the 15th, no. 16th, no. 17th. And he went all the way through every single month. It was like no, 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 all the way until the 13th again. So then he was like, again, had he said, okay, 13th, he would have had to, anyways, in parentheses, mom doesn't say this, but think about it, right? He would have had to wait an entire year until the 13th of Nisan of the next year. So at that point, he was like, oh, maybe the month is bad, hoping that maybe it's 13th of Iyar that he can come up with, and then it's like the next month. It's like 1 month away. And so then he goes, Iyar, no. Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, right? And he went through each of the months and picked them up, and it was like, no, 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 until he got all the way back around the year till Adar. And then it was finally the yes, right? The last month that he tried, it was a yes, and that's why it went on the 13th of Adar.
Basically, the 13th of Adar was the only day he really wanted. Why didn't he just pick that from the beginning?
He did not want 13th of Adar. He wanted 14th of Nisan. He was doing it on the 13th of Nisan. He wanted 14th of Nisan. Right? He wanted the next day. But instead, he got 11 months later. He got literally the last date that, according to how he did the Goral, he possibly could have come out with. Which again, Malam said he should have seen that there was something supernatural here.
Why didn't he just pick that day? Like, why
didn't
he even do a
gorilla? Yeah, I don't know. That's the whole thing, right? Again, Malam says, like, this was, like, a common practice back then. They used to do gorilla. I don't know. I can't answer that question. That seems to be, like, a cultural, like, Persia Media question. I don't know. My assumption is, right, that, like, actually, it's funny. I just tell my babysitter the story. When I was in Colombia, there was a Muslim in one of my classes whose name was Saeed. So he had the same first name and last name, and every teacher would always call his name and be like, Saeed, oh, I think there's a typo because it has your last name. And he's like, no, my name is actually Saeed. So finally I had a teacher who was like, why is your name Saeed? And he said that he was like the seventh, eighth kid of his family. And his father was like very, very, really wanted to name him Saeed. And his mother was like, no, we are not naming our kid Saeed. So they put all the names that they were thinking of in a hat and they drew out. They were going to like, whatever name we pick, that's what we're going to name our kid. And they drew out Saeed 3 times in a row. Like, they would do it, they drew it out, and they were like, and his mom was like, no, we're doing that again. And then they'd be like, we're doing it again. And by the third time, she was like, fine. So that's how we got his name, Saeed. Right? So again, like, why were they doing a raffle? Because the assumption was, like, there's going to be some sort of, like, hashgacha, and God will help us pull out the name that we really should name our child. So once they pulled up the name 3 times, she was like, even her, who's like, I don't want to name my kid Saeed. She's like, okay, there's got to be some sort of spiritual reason that, you know, Allah wants us to name our kid Saeed.
As a side point, like, what does God have to say that, like, doing things like that?
What is who?
What does the Torah have to say about doing, like, Goralim? Is that, like, a Jewish thing? Is that anti? Is that considered gambling? Like, I remember, bringing in Yahushua, like, they would also, like, raffles, no?
Well, there was, like, a raffle to divide up Eretz Yisrael. But, again, then it's very different, I think, if you have a raffle with the correct assumption of, like, direct hashgacha, or if you have, like, a raffle which is, like, you know, I'll flip a coin and then I'll, you know, do this, or I'll flip a coin and I do that. I don't know. I don't think. Let's table that for next time, because I just want to finish the discussion and then we'll pause and we could discuss that. I think everything that you guys were saying was exactly what I was thinking also. I wonder if it's, I mean, I think the most part exactly like you're saying is to stress the evilness of Haman in contrast and qualitatively as different than everybody else. And I wonder if part of it is also just like the way that we look at the world, you know, if we have choices in general, but there are klal of like, you know, have I done the kops klus? Have I done it's called adam kops klus? In a way, not like in a fluffy way, but like, if we don't know this person is evil, then we assume that they're basically good. They could be manipulated, like Chavi's saying, they don't have to be like a great king. Like, you shouldn't have given your ring to somebody else to like make decrees and have no idea what's going on in your kingdom, but you're not evil, right? If there's a way that we see people as not evil, that's what we choose. If we could see it like that, like maybe it's also part of our genetic, like spiritual makeup that we assume that evil is a big deal. It's a really big deal. And in this story, Haman is evil. Ahasuerus is misled. A lot of other people do things. Bigthan and Zeresh aren't the great, you know, not everyone is like a upstanding individual, but how many people are evil? One. It's rare to find a human who's evil. Haman was one of them. And this story is about how Hashem took him down.